Hit it, Phil.
Can it be the breeze that fills the trees with rare and magic perfume? Oh, no! It isn't the breeze, it's Jackson time.
Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. Today we have something exciting for you. We're going to go in depth on Kathy Fuller Seeley's new book, Jack Benny's Lost Radio Broadcast. This is the hardback copy. It's $52 on Amazon, but it's only $40 if you go to Ben Omart's Bear Manor Media. And so I'm going to have the connection to Bear Manor Media so you can get this book if you like. It's very lovely. It's well done. Very similar to Kathy's Volume 1 and 2. This is Volume 3. And it is a lovely book. And we have an interview with Kathy that I did last month. I think this is the first time I'm going to be airing it. So enjoy this interview with Kathy Fuller Seeley and pick up the book if you can. In the show notes, I'll have links to the book so you can get it. And we will see you folks next time. Enjoy this interview. Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. I have Kathy Fuller Seeley with me. We're doing a special recording here, interview about her new book that's coming out, and it's actually out right now. So it's exciting. You can go and get it over on Amazon, but we'll get all into that as we go. So Kathy, this is, let me just introduce Kathy's series first. So we had, this is the first volume in the series.
And here's the second volume.
There's backwards. One and two. Look at that. Backwards. And the third one now is going to be a yellow volume. And that one, like I say, is out now. The first one, first volume, had one script in it, the first script that was from that we have the recording of, the very first episode of the Jack Benny Show. Mm-hmm. But all the rest of them were unavailable as far as an audio format, weren't available. And of course, you can't get the scripts anywhere else. So she shared with us essentially 20, 25-ish scripts that we could get to 24 or whatever it was, 23 when you take out the first one. And then the second volume, none of them are available in audio form, I don't think.
I don't think so.
So it's all the next series of scripts, right? And so that's the second volume.
Each one is sort of 13 weeks of scripts because Jack was on the air twice a week. In the day.
So then she presents the second volume. The second volume, what's probably most notable about it is it's got all the scripts we've never seen before. But the final script, I believe, is the introduction of Mary, if I remember right, the first one. So it's kind of cool that each book has something really special. Yeah. That's what's special about that book. Second book, the special thing within those scripts that are in there is at the end, toward the end, it might even be the last script, but I don't think so. It's towards the end. We have the very first film spoof that they do, that becomes a standard feature on the show. And so that's really cool that's incorporated.
And also that Jack and Mary fall in love and they actually have romantic scenes together in number two. They painted themselves into a corner, Jack and Harry Kahn. And so they immediately go back in the other direction and have her trying to get the orchestra boys to take her out. And
now, is that a multi-episode thing? I think it was.
There's two or three scripts that lead up to jealousy back and forth and then confessing their love for one another. And it's like, you'll never see that again.
Right. So. Well, it's so interesting. And I think you mentioned this before, but I always talk about how similar it is to Seinfeld and things, the Jack Benny Show and things. And in Seinfeld, within that first or second season, Elaine and Jerry started having an affair on the show for one episode, I believe. And then after that, they never, ever do that again. That was, you know... so it's almost the same. I mean, it's like, I just thought it was strange how that also echoed in the Seinfeld show as well. And in the same way, it wasn't like so often on a TV show or something, or they'll wait until like one of the, we're out of story ideas. Let's hook them up. You know, they've been on and off again or whatever for so many years, and will they or won't they, and let's do it. And then it, the show usually is on its dying stages by that time. And then what I love is people always go, oh yeah, the show got canceled because they got married or whatever. And it's like, no, the show is losing its ratings before any of that happened. Then you got the couple married in a desperate attempt to gain viewers, and then it got canceled. So you can't just say when people get married, that's when the show becomes boring, because it's not necessarily true.
That's true. One of the only things that tells the lie to that is that Burns and Allen changed their show to have them be married, and it gave them new life.
So. That's true. And then I think of shows like Bewitched, where they were married. I think the first season has them as fiancés, and then they get married within the first few episodes, and they're married from there on. And of course, the show was a big hit and lasted for years and years and years. And if that was true, that it become boring when you have a married couple, then that we also, honestly, Lucy and Desi, they're married from the very beginning, and people tuned into that show all along. So yeah, so it kind of takes a lie to that. But I do think it's interesting
how with Jack and Mary
and with Seinfeld, how they did it very early on, played with it, and then decided to go away a different direction. Anyway, let's talk about the new book and what's going on in that book. So that's the next 26 episodes, 25.
Yes.
And there was one that was missing from volume two. Is that in volume three, or is that?
I included the missing one from volume two is in volume three, but now there's one that's lost from volume three that we haven't found.
And we may never find,
but Laura Leibowitz read it once. And so this may be a continuing.
Oh my goodness. So it exists somewhere because Laura actually read it.
It might, but I hired a research assistant who just searched everywhere in those books, and we couldn't. If the missing one from volume three is Christmas Day, 1932, December 25th, 1932. And it's like, oh, darn it. But, she has a synopsis of it, and so we'll see if we can one day find it. Yeah. I'll have to go back out to California myself.
So it's so sad. We have one missing, but we have 75 now-ish that we've never, ever been able to experience in any way, shape, or form, and now you've created 75. Who would have thought? I mean, it's still mind-blowing.
I'm very grateful to the Benny family. The Benny family and Benny estate for allowing me to do this.
Yes.
Because when I first considered the project, the people at the UCLA archive said, there is no way. We will not allow you to photograph a page. You can only take a few notes. You can't do this. And so I'm both grateful to the family that I give Jack more than half the royalties of all the $10 I've earned from this book. I credit him as the author. If I could ever find a relative of Harry Kahn, I'd have to credit them too. But and the wonderful publisher, Ben Omart, is a fabulous person. His books, he brings in the best authors in entertainment, film, television, radio, history, and studies. He's the books are beautifully produced and reasonably.
Ben's publishing company we wouldn't have many of these books. I don't think other publishing companies would publish them. And it's his niche is radio and television, and it's my interest area totally. I mean, my gosh, his catalog of show. I mean, I go to his website or whatever, and you just look at it and go,
and more,
that
more,
one
more,
and that more. One be interesting, this one and this one, and so many that are interesting. So and yours are among those, which is fantastic. Hers currently is out in paperback as we speak, and so you can order it from Amazon, like we say. Hardback version's not out yet. I assume that'll be coming at some point. So those of you who, if you've already collected the hardback volumes, don't worry, there'll be a hardback volume of it. Those of you who are wanting it right away, get the paperbacks just fine. Before we get into that volume, because I know that's we're going to discuss that and a lot of it's a really interesting volume, probably almost the most interesting out of all three, really. But I just want to talk about the future for this series and things. I was just wondering, have you decided yet? I mean, because you're going to start hitting where you're running into episodes that do exist that we have,
yes.
But we have them in like terrible audio quality.
Yeah.
Or many, many we have where we have, like, because they were done on, I'm not sure how they, I think we're done on separate discs. And so you, so lots of times we'll have the first 15 minutes or the last 15 minutes or one of the whole show. I'm assuming for at least those that are missing half the show, you will get the scripts and do those, I would assume.
Sure. It's a good point. Ben Omart, the publisher, has been so kind. He has committed to publishing every single script if that's what we want to do. The issue I'm going to run into in that Buck Benny era is that they do start to sound similar.
Yes.
And so indeed, to keep, you know, Ben in my corner, it may be that I end up excerpting things that don't exist, you know, to because there's so, you know, so...
Yeah.
We'll see. But as soon as I can get the Jello years are fantastic. As soon as we can get to the fall of 34, when they start doing more and more of the parodies.
Yes.
First
Jello season, we have so few of those episodes. Yeah. We have some, but that's going to be huge because one, they're high quality episodes that are well written and everything, more like what we're kind of or. I shouldn't even say that because the ones you released are high quality and they're great. They're just different than the later episodes of Jack Benny. Whereas the 1934 episodes start to 1934 and 35 start to really reflect more of what the future Benny shows will be.
Yeah.
So those ones I'm really excited to get, and there'll be a lot of them.
I can't wait. It's going to be great fun.
Once we actually hit the true Jello years, I mean when Phil joins, right? There are maybe 15, 20 missing episodes for the rest of the run. And that's, so there's not a lot.
Yeah.
But hopefully
everybody's going to be surprised at how interesting the Frank Parker episodes are. They write him quite, he's unique. He is more mature than either Kenny or Dennis.
Okay.
And plays with undertones of sophistication or sexuality. They're more, a little more gay humor, geared toward himself. There's all kinds of fun things to come. So
I'm so looking forward to all of that. But let's hop into this volume. So this one you've told us a few times in our different podcasts we've done and things that it has a quite a bit longer intro than the previous intros to the previous volume. So there's so much more for you to talk about. There's so much going on.
All new. So nothing comes from previous books or, you know, adapted from other things. And it turns out there was so much story to tell that I'm sort of sorry that I hadn't put it in the previous book, but now to get to tell the story here, this was perhaps both on mic and behind the scenes, perhaps the most stressful 13 to 15 weeks of Jack Benny's career, only matched by what's going to happen when he gets fired from Chevrolet. And a lot of that is going to happen outside of publicity. So it's fascinating how much what happens to Jack Benny was discussed in the trade press and in among newspaper radio reviewers and editors in papers across the U.S. So it was fascinating to uncover the details of this story, and I'm very glad that there were all kinds of materials available because they weren't in Jack Benny's own papers.
Well, and what we have to keep in mind with Jack and this, like you say, this turmoil, both at Chevy and this one, is that it wasn't like later on when he loses Jello or whatever. I mean, yes, he's probably like, oh, yeah, well, you know, but he's like, he knows he'll find somebody else. He knows he's this
right.
successful
show. At that point,
he
was at the top of the game.
I mean, when you're at the top of your game, and you have this right. big following, you go, well, I'll find another sponsor, I'll switch to the network or yeah. whatever. But at this stage of the game, when it's happening in 33, 32, 33, 34, 35, anytime in there, everything that's happening, it's like, you got to remember, this is a young to the medium performer to radio, and he's probably going, I might be just done. I might not be able to get another yep. sponsor. I might not be able to do another show. I might just be gone. And you said previously, that's what the media sort of was thinking. They're like, oh, he's lost that, so he's done for. No one wants to use a guy.
Exactly. So it's a lot like the business about the streaming wars. What's going on with the sort of new platform of streaming services? And nobody knows quite what's going to happen next. There are, you know, so many different streaming services, and they're having to raise their prices, and they don't know if they can keep attracting customers. And so there's a lot of turmoil. Mm-hmm. And this is a fascinating way of finding out that Jack Benny was in the middle of all that turmoil.
Yes.
Because in his own autobiographies, in his own statements, he always wanted to represent himself as having this smooth and happy, you know, and rapid rise to fame and prominence. He always wants to smooth over anything wrong, you know, anything negative or anything contentious, and to say it was always so easy. And it's fascinating to find out, oh, he's in the thick of it. He's having to fight for his very career to learn how powerful the sponsors could be at that time, because we generally think of the networks as being the powerful ones,
right,
from classic TV of the 50s and 60s. And this really brings out how radio in the 30s was very much a sponsor's medium, and they could pick you up or drop you at a moment's notice.
Right.
And
amazing.
So
I was just going to point out while we're talking about this, before I forget, because I didn't mention it before, but certainly in the show notes down below this, you'll see connections to the Amazon version of her new book that you can get. And if you order it, because this is coming out, we're going to film this today. I might even get it out today, or at least by tomorrow. And so if you're watching this, and it's, you know, this is 2023. And so if you're in December 2023, chances are you might be able to order it and get it in time for Christmas, or put it on your Christmas list so you can get that. So there's that. We'll have that version. But then I think Kathy was saying, is there a package where you get all three of them, or are we just talking
about? I believe Ben Omar, the publisher, is working toward bundling promotions. So
I'll go to Ben's website and connect up however it connects up there, whether I can connect with the bundle or the individual copy or whatever. Just know if you order from Ben, my thoughts would be you probably wouldn't get it before Christmas. It'll be after Christmas, but that's okay too. Right. And it's a little cheaper there, I think, than it is on Amazon probably. And the price, and I did notice, just so people don't complain or whatever, the price did go up a little bit since last time she published, but everything else has gone up too. So that's the way it is.
Yeah, I saw the paperback was $40 even, and I'll send anybody a penny who wants a penny so that they could say their list price was $39.99. So
sweet. Now you're going to get all these letters sent to you for sending
a penny. I want a penny. Give me a penny.
But then they are a true Jack Benny fan if they do that.
This is true. So as I said, I highly recommend this volume.
Yeah.
Both for, you'll read in it scripts that are very un-Benny like. Mm-hmm. But so both in the scripts themselves, stuff that Jack wanted to paper over that we finally get to experience, as well as the story behind the mic.
And who's the other actor that's introduced in this that they wanted to take?
It was interesting to learn more about Sid Silver's career. He's not the bad guy.
Right.
And the way I had always thought of the story previously was it was evil Sid Silver and all this. And I think Sid was just as much, a minor player in all this. Just
right.
He's also trying to make a living. What I learned about Silvers, I was about maybe 10 years younger than Jack Benny, from New York City. He in vaudeville, he had gained prominence as sort of being one of the originators of the stooge role. For earlier comedians, he would be stationed out in the vaudeville theater in the audience and heckle the comedian on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so didn't come out as a partner on stage,
right,
but was placed in the audience to, as I said, to give back talk to and heckle
right.
the comedian. So that was what, you know, that was the niche he was kind of known
yeah.
for. So in the fall of 1932, he was involved in a musical comedy that actually had Ethel Merman in a major first role for her. He was playing the stooge role, the second comic with maybe with Jack Haley, who we know as the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz, but who had a huge career. And
yeah.
so he's part of somebody's trying to mount a musical comedy show, and it's in tryouts. From Philadelphia and trying to go to Pittsburgh, and the show has many, many problems, and it's the worst days of the Depression, right? And
right.
the show ends up falling apart by the end of September 1932. So he's at loose ends, and he's known for being this, popular as this stooge, and so you can see the advertising agency. And Canada Dry, we'll paint N.W. Ayer and Son as the true villain here. You see them frustrated. They're frustrated with Jack's show. They've never liked it.
Right.
And they say, aha, here is somebody who's suddenly available. And his specialty is witty comebacks. And say maybe they're saying that's what would be more traditional
yep.
In comedy shows on vaudeville. And so that's what we want Jack to do. So, but the worst part is they don't tell Jack. They just
right.
implant it on him. And in fact,
and Sid Silver's defense, chances are they painted to him as, well, this is a struggling show that's probably going to not, Jack's going to lose it unless we do something to punch it up. So we're bringing you in. You're going to save the show.
Right,
it's probably
right.
how they presented it to Sid, I would think.
Yes. You know, you're out of work. It's a really hard times. Here's something you're good at. We're going to attach you to this show. And they also hired Friedman, the joke specialty writer who worked for Eddie Cantor.
Okay.
But it's possible that it was a 1-2 punch, that first they send Jack and Mary and Harry Kahn to New Orleans to meet up with the new band leader, Ted Weems. And because they only start talking about Sid Silvers and this new plot that they must follow of Jack becoming a theatrical producer on the show about 5 episodes into this new regime. And so, you know, I just feel so bad for Jack and Mary and Harry Kahn of just having, as I said, of their autonomy taken away from them. They need this job.
Well, I feel bad for Sid too, because he comes in and doesn't probably realize that there's going to be all this contention and all these issues, and
right.
it's like, oh my gosh,
he's just doing his job. And
yeah.
There's about 5 more episodes in which Sid is on the show, but
he's on for like a total of like 10-ish episodes. Is that kind
yes.
of right?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now. I just, because I've never gotten this in my head quite right, and maybe you can help me adjust. So at the beginning of the book, are we going to get a few kind of normalish episodes like the last few books, and then
oh,
this
okay.
happens, or does this happen right from the get-go?
It happens the first episode of the new 15-week period. On the very first episode is suddenly, I mean, the last
Sid
episode
all of a sudden
of volume,
shows up.
The last episode of Volume 2, the goodbye episode with
yes.
George Olsen and yeah. Ethel Schutte, and they're all sad, and, you
yeah.
know, they've worked this group, you know, they've got a real a collegial cast thing going
yeah.
on with the boys and the band, and they're and so the first episode is literally Jack and Mary on the train heading south. So it's just the two of them around
yeah.
the microphone, and with Harry coming up to talk with them. So
okay.
it's literally autobiographically following their journey down to New Orleans for all,
wow.
you know, how far from New York City could you get is to New Orleans.
So
where,
and you're saying Harry Kahn actually has this, are you saying Harry Kahn?
He's a character. This is the time in which he becomes a prominent character on the show in this time period, because they've lost. They don't have band leader. They don't have the boys in the band.
So they need somebody.
And so Harry pitches in, and you'll hear more from Harry, who is actually playing a kind of stooge character.
Interesting.
He is what Sid Silvers would become. And that's another reason why Harry is so mad at them. But it's very sweet and kind of autobiographical. They are playing Jack and Mary on the train going to New Orleans, and she's a little bit of a flibbertigibbet, but you know they're a couple. This also represents Mary Livingston's part becoming much larger. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, instead of being the newcomer with these professional performers, Olsen and Chute, you know, suddenly she needs to fill the role.
Yeah.
And she's doing a great job. I wish we had these recordings as just to get this on the things you can't.
That's what I was going to say. Even if we had like that episode, I'd love to have the one you're describing, the very first one. And then one or two of the Sids would be nice to see.
Yeah.
Also, the first one would be nice, and then it's got Harry Conn. I would love to hear Harry Conn and what he sounds like on the episodes would be neat. But
So they're down in New Orleans. They're getting to know Ted Weems. Andrea Marsh is about 17, and she has very few. She doesn't have much speaking mic experience. So they're not using her, and they're not using Ted very much. And so Jack's there for a week or two. Then Jack must go back to New York. This is where I think they insert it's possible that this is when they also lowered the boom that they were going to add Sid Silvers to the cast. Mm-hmm. So Jack has to leave them. And Harry Conn and Mary Livingston have to do, I believe, two episodes in New Orleans by themselves.
Wow.
Without Jack. And what Harry chooses to do, I think in retrospect, is kind of shocking and fabulous and amazing. They do a version of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, mind you, Uncle Tom's Cabin was the most hated production in the South at that point, because it's about the sympathy for Uncle Tom and poor Eliza running away from the evil slave driver. Mm-hmm. Tom companies up through the 1920s knew not to try and perform in the South, or were kicked out.
Right.
So, I said, here
and this
are
is a
nationwide
show, so it's going to play in the South that are not going to be happy.
Yes. Yeah. You know, they're broadcasting from New Orleans. They're broadcasting across the South, the East, and the Midwest. And it's a parody of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Yeah. With, you know, it's very much about Eliza. It's, you know, I mean, so it's just played for the humor. And I have not yet found any reaction to it. But I can just kind of imagine that the Southern listeners would be appalled. And what Canada Dry and NW Air is thinking, maybe, as I said, this may have sealed the deal of why they need to hire more writers. Because this is pretty outrageous that you've done this. So, but after about the fourth episode, they introduced the character of Sid Silvers, but Harry Conn has to voice him because they're not back in New York yet.
Oh, so, strange. So his character's introduced, but not played by the actor. And also, does the character have the actor's name then, apparently?
Yes. Hi, I am...
Oh, another human being that's not there. Wow.
It's crazy. And they actually introduce, hey, we're changing the story of our show now. They actually say that. I'm becoming a Broadway producer, and I'm going to be putting on a show called, like, Bubbles of 1933, something like. So the name of the show changes episode to episode, and it becomes a continuing narrative, something unlike... Oh. Other than our the multi-part trip to to Yosemite, we're never going to have the Benny Show be a continuing narrative again. But every single episode takes us further into finding a backer for the show, interviewing a leading man, rehearsing the chorus girl.
And they're still on twice a week.
They're on at two bizarrely different times. Thursdays at 8 p.m., Sundays at 10 p.m. Who is going to find this show?
That's bizarre.
Who is going to find this show? So they switched networks. to CBS. They've gone to different nights of the week at two different times.
Yep. So, and I heard you paid a phenomenal amount to a special effects production company to get the microphone changed to CBS from NBC on the cover. That's just amazing.
I wanted it to look, somebody complained on Facebook, and they're allowed to, that it looked amateurishly done and it wasn't the correct microphone. I don't care. I wanted to
say CBS. So
you'll find on the cover of the third album that I took this marvelous picture from 1934-35 and just had pasted a 1930s CBS microphone on it. I wanted to play up the absurdity that the sponsor put Jack and Mary and Harry Kahn through by switching them to a new network. And they would only be on CBS for these 13 weeks before they're summarily fired. And then Jack ends up back on NBC from March 1933 until December 1948. So they said you'll see it, and I wanted it to look kind of stupid, pasted in and kind of dumb.
Well, and so, now my question for you, related to that, just because you're the author, editor, whatever you want to call it for these books, and part of the production team for the books or whatever. So that picture you're using that you've used on all the books so far, right? Yeah. That's the first volume. If I remember right, I think we've talked about this before, and you said that it was maybe, if it strikes me right, I might be remembering a wrong conversation, but that it takes a lot of work to get permission to use an official picture. Yes, so many pictures are just floating around the internet, but you don't know who owns them.
Tell the folks, it cost me $600 to get the rights to use this iconic photograph on the Jack Benny book that I published with the University of California Press. And I begged. They were going to charge me like $800. And I said, please, I'm a poor academic. So Ben is kind of more laid back, but any publisher these days, they're so worried about being sued or not having the rights to things. It's very difficult to use original photographs. University of California Press wanted me to get permission from both the subject of any photograph, but also the photographer. How are you going to find that from somebody from 1935?
Or their family or estate or something years later.
What the loophole I could use was, this image comes from a advertisement put into the trade journals. Mostly I got this from Fortune magazine.
Okay.
The advertising agency Young and Rubicam of the Jell-O years put out when Jack Benny's show had shot up to be number one, and they were so proud that they published a beautiful, simple, full-page ad in Fortune magazine that used this wonderful photograph. And if I bought a copy of the magazine or the page, the ad, and say it came from the collection of Kathy Fuller Seeley, I could then give myself permission.
Well, that's cool. Well, and then the question is, are you planning on all the future volumes keeping that same picture, or at some point are you going to change to something else?
No. That's because if the series kind of ends, or at least is through 36, I was going to use the same photograph.
I think so. He's got gray hair. That's about as old as he ever looks. So
Exactly. It's good for a long time.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And now, if you're reprinting scripts from the CBS time frame, you've already got one that you can pull that same cover out for this temporary.
Well, there you go. No. By that point, by CBS will have something much nicer looking with slightly different gray and dyed hair. So it's fun to set apart these 13 weeks.
Yeah.
Luckily, there is one other source for these early Benny radio manuscripts for the couple that were missing from Jack's own collection, which is out at UCLA.
Okay, so you had a few missing.
The NBC scripts were collected by somebody at NBC and microfilmed in terribly tiny shape. But there are, and they microfilmed every script and every advertisement script throughout the entire broadcast day.
Okay.
And did it kind of chronologically. And then took microfilm images of them. And the Library of Congress has these things called the NBC master file. That's where I was able to find the couple missing scripts that are not in Jack's own collection, but there is no CBS master file. So I'm very grateful that this is the only, that only this 13-week period was Jack with CBS.
Nice.
In this, because otherwise they're gone.
And so that's why the one that's missing from this set,
frustrating because, but as I said, but Laura Leibowitz saw it at one point when she was doing her original 39 Forever volume, which I have here somewhere. She read the Christmas Day 1932.
She just doesn't know where she read it. So,
right. So I think it's possible that it's misfiled sometime in the middle of 33 or 34.
Okay.
And it'll take me going back and sifting through all the photographs I took, and I'll find it eventually. But
okay. Hopefully. We'll see. But it's just great to have this many that you've found and you've done. And this is just such a great thing. I was wondering, I mean, and we'll keep on talking more about this volume, but so you do the Jack Benny book that's behind you, which is your first book. That was a scholarly work that you were doing on Jack Benny and got it published and everything. So, and a lot of people, I assume, contacted you and were like, oh, this is great. And we love this and everything, that we're Jack Benny fans and stuff. I mean, certainly I was one of them. But then what made you decide from going to that to going back to the original scripts, and what was the genesis of this thing?
That's a very kind question. I'd had it in mind as in something I'd wanted to do from the time I just started researching this book. This took me about 10 years of research before I got it published. And way back when, I said, oh, I'd dearly love to have these scripts that nobody's able to see.
Yeah.
Because they're hidden in the bowels of UCLA. And at the time, I couldn't find a publisher. No one was willing to commit to it. And that's where I'll reiterate, I'm ever so grateful to Ben Omar to be willing.
Well, how did you figure out, did someone give you a clue that maybe Ben Omar publishes this kind of thing, or did you just figure it out on your own?
I started seeing his books come out and so admired, you know, all the things he did. And I just contacted
him. And he's had some other script books, like for Lone Ranger or whatever. He's done some of these, I think, before. Nothing of this. It's always been like one or two volumes. It hasn't been like a 10 volume thing or whatever this will end up being.
He may have a massive Amos and Andy set in the works. But who knows? So I'm so grateful that he can find a way to afford, because it costs a lot of money to typeset this stuff. You know, the work that goes, of course, my labor is free, but, it takes a lot of money to produce.
Oh, yeah.
A book that, you know, if it's not going to be a million copies.
Well, and the fact that I don't know. I have such a hard time judging what a normal fan thinks versus a super fan thinks versus a podcaster thinks. But anyway, when I was listening to these, and then especially when I did my intros to all of them and everything, all the Jack Benny episodes, I was always like so excited when I'd run into like one of the tobacco scripts that wasn't available, and so I could read it, and when I read it, like I'd hear Jack's voice and all the characters. I mean, it was like after I read it, I'd walk away and say, did I read that episode or did I listen to that episode? And I couldn't keep track anymore, right? And so I thought, boy, what a neat thing if you could get these scripts that are missing. But I was like, you know, maybe the tobacco years, we get some of them and things, and that's great. But beyond that, I thought, there's just no way. I mean, I saw a bound volume of scripts come up that were from the 35 through 37 range or something. The person was asking like $1,100 for it or something. And it's just, I couldn't justify that kind of price for it. But then these come, then you do these, and they're exactly what I'm looking for at a reasonable price. I mean, I don't know what we're talking. We're probably talking a couple dollars per script that you're reading. I mean, yeah. for the consumer, for someone like me, I'm paying $2 and I get to read an original Jack Benny script that I can't get any other way. And I'm just so excited by that. I mean, it's just amazing. Well, yeah.
I appreciate your super fandom tremendously, because I also wanted, one of my goals was to recuperate the reputation of these earliest years. Because if you read anything about Jack Benny that was written, everybody just dismisses. And they always just say the show only got good in 36 or 37.
Yeah.
So they'll just dismiss these first years. Of no, they were crap. They were, you know, and just as you say, with the even the Buck Benny scripts we have, they're scratched, they're old. You don't have the context. You don't, and they are different. I mean, I'm not. I don't mean to sugarcoat them. Jack Benny is not full in these early volumes. He is not fully the Jack Benny that we know.
Right.
He's more of a little bit more of a Jerry Seinfeld character. The mm-hmm. kind of a slightly cocky Broadway Romeo, as
yeah.
his vaudeville character had been. He
and Mary's not what Mary eventually would become. Mary's
right. No, Mary's not. And they are
kind of a dumber
no
girl
Dennis,
sort of
no
thing.
Phil, but it is so interesting. As I said, what really drew me in was this process of experimentation and learning that Jack and Harry Conn went through. To see the things that they tried and gave up on, to see the roots of things, because the writers all the way up through the end of his television career had access to all these scripts. And it is marvelous when I find from the first 13 weeks, the dog who can count that is in the Dr. Pusin episode in 1950.
Right.
Originated in 1932. So you find marvelous things. This new volume has the first Van Twiffs versus Diddlebury feud, yeah. The long running Kentucky Hillbilly feud has its very first script, which is remarkably like what it would become in future years.
Now, we haven't had yet the first Christmas shopping script, have we?
Oh no. No. That I don't believe. Although there are some fascinating things. There's one coming up in the next batch of the Chevrolet batch about Jack going out to Don's house for a meal, and
right.
then coming walking back and meeting all these characters and getting into all kinds of trouble. And so
mm-hmm.
there are marvelous things.
Yeah.
That don't get repeated in the future,
right.
but also other bits that are reworked and developed and
right.
things like that.
Because for years I talked about the 1937 shopping episode as the very first Christmas shopping episode, mm-hmm. but then I was reading through Laura's book that summarizes all the even the lost episodes,
yeah.
and there's at least one or two in there that are some kind of shopping is part of it for Christmas shopping. I don't remember whether it's in 35 or 34. It's obviously after these scripts,
yeah.
but finding things like that are the germ of an idea that explodes mm-hmm. and becomes more later, I think is so
yeah,
interesting for the fan. Yeah.
It's great. It's yeah. Hooray. It's something new in an era, in this era in which so many things like our superhero movies are, you know, I mean, so many things are sequel. So many things are
yes.
using the same little idea and repeating it.
Yes.
To see origins of things, backstory
yes.
is fun. So,
now, now you were saying that in the first script in this book, they're going on a train trip somewhere, right?
To New Orleans, yes.
Yeah.
Just Jack and Mary and Harry. So
is that anything like the later train episodes? Is there any little pieces in there that you feel
they're sitting there and talking and joking and Mary's yeah. flirting with somebody. It's very odd.
Which
she
is,
tries to get some random man to buy her dinner.
But that's sort of what Mary does later on too, somewhat. So no,
yeah.
I think that's interesting.
So yeah, it has that similar kind of feel and
a little bit of flavor
fun to it.
Yeah.
And yet that's where the change to Jack having to become a Broadway producer is so strange, because he is spending money. You know, he's saved up the same little bit of wry, self-deprecating jokes, but he becomes more the straight man.
Yeah, but, at this point, he's not cheap yet, is he? I mean, it wasn't one of the other characters cheap?
He's willing to flirt with the chorus girls more successfully.
And George Olsen character. Was the cheap character, wasn't he, for a while or something?
Right, yes. George Olsen started cheap, but what Sid Silvers is going to be is incredibly lazy and finding ways of scamming money out of people. Okay. And Jack just doesn't care. All the money goes away. Yeah. And he gets the original Schlepperman very early into this foray into Broadway producing to put up $100,000 in late 1932 money for this show. And, you know, it was just like...
And this, just to let audiences know, she's talking about the show behind the show. I mean, this is not... Yes. She's not saying that Schlepperman is real and is putting up money. This is a character.
And it's not even played by Sam Hearn.
Right.
So it turns out that Harry Connick has invented the Schlepperman character before Sam Hearn comes along.
Yeah.
And
because we have
he's a loaded showbacker.
Yeah, because the first Sam Hearn version of Schlepperman we have in audio format, which is great. Mm-hmm. But this predates that. By a good year or more. So that's just exciting that we get to hear the beginnings of Schlepperman. Was the character written somewhat the same? Can you tell it's the Schlepperman character?
Or no, he just doesn't. The same he's name? Not playing with language. He's not playing with Yiddish phrasing. He's just, so I don't know what, I think it was Ralph Ashe, perhaps, playing Schlepperman at that point, but you don't get any of the kind of indication that he's brought on, you know, hello stranger, and you know, so the part is not written phonetically. I don't know what the actor did with it, but it's just Schlepperman in name only.
See, my thought would be maybe the Schlepperman actor was a Jewish actor that carried a little more of that, and so then as a writer, Khan is going, oh, I kind of like that, and I'll play that up a little bit, and maybe that's why it changes over time.
So we'll find out. There's a year and some to go to see, to dive deep. Because I haven't gone through the Chevrolet years with a fine tooth comb.
Right.
I've kind of had, you know, I take each volume as it comes.
Now, the Chevrolet years, are they one episode a week or still on the two episodes?
Yes, no, hooray. By the time Chevrolet inherited, Jack was able to inherit the time slot from Al Jolson, and it switches to once a week instead of twice a week. Thank God. So
is this the last volume of Twice a Week, or is there one more?
No, this is the last volume of Twice a Week.
Okay, and then, so the next volume is going to be the Chevrolet?
Chevrolet, which is March to June. And then they go off for the summer, and then they come back for about three more months, and then they get fired in like January again. So, okay.
But all that will fit into a volume, you think?
I'm hoping so. Yeah. You know, just as we've talked about, if the scripts get a little mundane and repetitive, I might find ways of excerpting them to get on toward the good stuff.
Right. So, or you can, and the volumes could get. Some of them could be thicker than other volumes and thinner. And
you know, Sears catalog, like.
Yeah, maybe not quite that big.
I'll find ways to do it. But like I said, the digging in deeply, keeping
my notes. It's Kathy's next volume. There you go.
But that digging in deeply was what helped me discover something that just hadn't occurred to me. And I'd never seen really played up the fact that Gracie Allen appears on the show on January 8th, 1933, along with George Burns, as a part of her famous running around to all the different radio shows looking for her missing brother, George.
Yeah.
And the fun part about doing research in the trade journals, in Variety and the advertising trade journals and in local newspapers was... the story was leaked very early on that this was an elaborate stunt put on by the advertising agency.
Right.
And they did it on purpose in hopes that when she ran over to, so she was on CBS too. She was on Lombardi's musical show, George and Gracie were, but they were on CBS. And so Jack was on CBS, so she was able to march into his show. But when she went...
convenient for us that he went over to CBS right at that time, so it happened to be
because,
there.
Yeah. Well, that because that didn't cause any... But when she went to Rudy Valley's Fleischman East show on NBC, NBC threw a huge hissy fit and knocked him off the air for about 5 seconds. Because they gave Rudy, they had said right before the show, you can't do that. You cannot, you can appear on the show, but you absolutely cannot talk about this cross, anything that would sniff of CBS. And so, but they did it anyway and gave Rudy the uncensored page to read. And so, as I said, NBC programmers up in the booth go nuts and knock him off the air for 5 seconds. And it made huge publicity. It did great to, you know, to build Gracie's reputation. It added so much publicity nationwide to the search for the missing brother. And they said, and the advertising agency did it on purpose, just because they hoped NBC would take the bait and get all upset about it.
Now, do you know much about...
I would just say that's because we always think of the Benny Allen feud as happening organically. And by 1937, they did a much better job of keeping the lid on the fact that it, too, was a manufactured feud.
Right,
together by the advertising agency.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask you if you knew much about the Gracie's search for a brother, because does she have a real brother named George?
Or? I believe so, who was really pissed off at all the people who would come up. He lived in San Francisco.
Okay.
People would come up to him and going, are you missing? And so, yeah.
Well, that makes sense. Okay. Because I was just like, if you were making this up out of whole cloth, why would you, when she's got George Burns,
right,
that is her husband, why would you create a fake brother that's named George? Why wouldn't you name it something else?
The basis of her routine since the 20s. Had been about the members of her family.
Okay.
You know, her sister Bessie, her father, her grandfather, her mother.
So people had heard of George's name and everything.
Oh, yeah. This was nothing new. It was just the trumped up thing of, I'm going to burst onto these other shows and go look for him. They carried it out for about a week, and they got huge national publicity, but because it only lasted about a week. So.
And then they revisited it. I guess years later, because this is 32, 33 we're at now?
January 33.
So it's in 33, and then in 1940, she does it again with the Gracie for President thing.
Gracie for President? Mm-hmm.
Which was much later, of course, and things.
And much more elaborate. This was a very one-off. It was supposed to be a surprise. So there was no elaborate build-up. Gracie is going to appear on these shows.
So it just felt like she just all of a sudden showed up on a show, would talk for a couple minutes about, have you seen my brother or whatever? And then that'd be kind of it.
And back in the day, guest stars were so rare. It was something different and new. And the local newspaper editors and reporters that I found commenting from like Milwaukee and another one in Pittsburgh and another one in St. Louis. And, you know, that's really help sort of play it up and go, oh, this is different. So
I'm kind of surprised that more people didn't jump on that boat where you saw, oh, there's Eddie Cantor all of a sudden showing up. I mean, they did guest starring things, but they didn't often show up for just a few minutes on each other's show.
Right. Well, no, that is because of the incredible power that sponsors had over their shows. They didn't want to. There was this belief in the same way that everybody, that the same sponsors, that nobody wanted to hire Jack after he gets fired by Canada Dry. There was all this talk that that comedians were incredibly intensely connected to the products they advertised. And so they, when Canada Dry fires Jack, he's got a stink about him. He's a used comedian. And the word among the advertising agencies was, oh no, people will so associate him with Canada Dry that no other sponsor will pick him up because they're not getting their money's worth.
Right.
So when it was totally sponsors and advertising agencies controlling programming, they were so jealous. You couldn't mention the name of your sponsor on somebody else's show back in the day unless you shared an ad agency. You know, oh, okay. I know Bob Hope, but you know what I mean? So yeah. There were all these restrictions and rules that were all about the sponsors going, no, I've paid for the whole program, and you're going to do exactly what we want and nothing else. So,
interesting.
It's cool. Okay. It's a part of, again, we think of television with its all-powerful networks, and it's so interesting to go back and learn about this other, the power of this other system back in the day.
Well, so. Especially with your back. So at your college, you teach classes on?
Film history, radio history, television history, all advertising history. I love all American media from the late 19th century through up to about the 1980s.
So this has to be hugely interesting for you to find this information out, to be able to share. I mean, it's totally in your wheelhouse.
That's it, because even the other scholars who've written about radio history, they've largely stayed away from commercial radio history. Mm-hmm. They're far more interested in news reporting or documentary or independent local stations. They've stayed away from the height of commercial radio because they said, that's boring. And right. So, again, making generalizations, and it's great fun. When you've introduced me so much to Jack Benny on television, and it's fascinating to think about that period, the continuing power of the sponsor.
Yes.
In early television versus sort of seeing how the networks take over the show. But in just the one we were talking about earlier this morning, the Christmas show for 1961, where they're doing the in the show commercial for Lipton tea, and Lipton owns that show. It's the only commercials, you know, I mean, so
yeah.
Again, television historians make a generalization. Oh, the networks took over right. all of TV programming at the time of the, after the quiz show scandal
right.
in the mid to late 50s. Well, here we are in December 61, with this show being totally controlled by advertising agencies.
And wasn't it at that time, was it alternating weeks where Lipton was in charge one week and then Carnation was in charge the next, or it was, I can't remember that.
They were,
well, Farmers Insurance was part of it once or something for part of it.
You're absolutely right. It was this period of experimentation.
Yeah.
And in part, it needed to happen because the costs of television production
right.
were just spiraling out of control, and no single sponsor had that kind of money anymore. Right. How much tea could you possibly sell?
And then I think with the sponsors, my guess is what the sponsors realized was, okay, us doing Lipton one week, especially on Jack's show, and then someone else doing something else for another week, when there's sometimes it could be multi-weeks between shows on in the 58, right. 57, that sort of time frame.
You would say, as an advertiser, I'm not getting very much impact.
Exactly. I'd rather have part of the show every week than all of the show every once in a while.
But interesting then. But the other thing that changed was that CBS and NBC started learning how much more money they could make if they had, instead of kinescopes, if they had filmed episodes.
Right.
And could rerun them. This is the lesson they learned from Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, that if you had permanent copies, that local TV stations had enormous amount of time to fill up during the day, late at night. And so they invented something that radio absolutely did not have, all being live and no reruns. Here's this, again, a new media form that has all this extra time in which if you could create programming, you could, start making. And so that's another reason why the networks started taking over programming, because they just saw money coming out.
What amazes me from that whole thing is they learn temporarily, filming is better because we can syndicate it better than kinescope, of course, and everything.
Yeah.
But then a decade later or something, they're like, it's so much cheaper to use videotape. Let's use videotape when the shows that continue to be filmed, In the modern age, we can convert those a lot easier and a higher quality to HD, right? Whereas you can't do that with a video.
No, but it was all, and then they would just retape over the video. The videotape was expensive.
Sometimes,
That's why we have so few Johnny Carsons, why we have so few episodes of some shows. They just tape over them again. Filming was very expensive, and there are so many hours of the day to fill, you know, in a three-channel universe.
And then you end up with shows like Happy Days is my favorite because it was filmed like the first year and a half or something, or two and a half, I don't know what it was, and then it went to videotape. And so now when you watch them, the clarity of the first couple years is so much higher than
and then you've got the additional problem that the original agreements didn't necessarily include the background music. So I met some really interesting folks from CBS, engineers who were going back into the episodes, and they were having to take out the copyrighted music and put in non-copyrighted music.
Which sounds horrible and everything. And it's like, if the character is referring to the song at all, it makes no sense.
Exactly. They were proud of an episode where they removed a Beach Boys song and just put it, and it was a dance contest, and it suddenly made you removed a whole layer of the pleasure of the show. Yeah. But that was, here, copyrights and royalties and all this stuff.
And I think that's why now so many shows almost don't have theme songs, or like you have the Lost theme song, which is one note, essentially. Yep. So you can't really copyright a note. So
So there's so many moving parts, and it's so easy for us to say, this happened because of this. And then the fun of history for me is going back and finding, there are all these other unintended consequences that add to it. Yeah. So,
well, let's go back to your book for a second, because I'm just thinking. So now Sid's in there. They get, they have a big battle. They get Sid out. They switch networks to CBS.
Okay. No, you've got it. They've switched networks to CBS. They've had to go to New Orleans, get a new singer, a new band, reconstruct the show and give Mary a much larger part, experiment with, are we going to give Harry a larger part? And he seems fairly reluctant to do it because he certainly could have written himself into every episode. And I kind of admire that he chose to stay in the background, because he could have, it could have been the Benny and Cotton show, and it wasn't. But as I say, just about the time they're leaving New Orleans, that's when I think they get the message that, no, you now must be a show about a Broadway producer, and you're going to have this annoying heckler, Sid Silvers, in the show.
Yes.
And so you've got about five or six episodes of that. As I said, interesting that it's a continuing narrative. Uh-huh. So unlike the we're going to show up and do something different every show, it's a continuing narrative. It introduces Schlepperman. Sid, what behind the scenes is making Mary so angry is that his attitude to her in the scripts that now he's co-writing, he's really putting Mary down. And really, she's not, he says hi, toots, and she, even in the scripts, you can see a little bit of
tension,
a little bit of friction there.
Yeah.
But behind the scenes, we learn there was a tremendous amount of friction, and Harry and Jack and Mary going for a showdown with the sponsor and advertising agency and say, end this stuff or we quit immediately. And Variety made a big deal about the fact that it was Mary Livingston who forced Sid off the show. I don't know what. It might be true. It might be a misogyny. We're going to talk about the grouchy woman. But it's interesting that here she is portrayed as saying, no, you've diminished my part. She'd just taken on that part.
Well, it's interesting that years later, as Phil leaves the show, on the Dinah show that we listened to where Mary and Phil are on there, Phil basically is like, Mary said I had to go and I was just done. Because I don't think Jack sort of has that in him. He's too nice of a guy or whatever. He can't can people too well. I don't think. I think most people just kind of left his show and he was like, okay, they weren't right for the part anyway, and then he gets somebody else until he finds the right person and locks them in. But essentially, people were just kind of leaving at times, certain characters, certain actors and things. Mm-hmm. But maybe Mary was the heavy, and maybe Mary got rid of Phil, and maybe Mary got rid of Sid.
Yeah, so it could very well be. And then it's fascinating to look in the trade press and the local press to see how everybody is sort of TMZing, gossiping about this.
Right.
There's one local writer in Brooklyn who is really playing up the everybody starts to take sides. So there are actual radio writer reporters who take Sid Silver's side and go, we're Team Sid. Jack Benny is terrible. We think Sid should get his own show. And there are others that go,
get him out of here.
They've appeared, they're in the same New York nightclub. Let's all watch and see how Jack and Sid, you know, deal with being in the same room. So the local gossip is kind of really amusing. But so they rejoice on about the 10th of December when they could say, hey, we're back to the old show format. We're gonna do our little movie parodies. We're going to do this and that. I'm no longer producing a Broadway show. And you can just sort of sense the relief. And they end up, Harry and Jack write parodies of a couple really risque Broadway shows that were being made into controversial films. Miss Sadie Thompson about the fight between the conservative minister and the prostitute in Pango Pango, doing some other things and bringing back their favorite character from Grand Hotel. They create a character called Kringleine.
Kringleine, that's right.
Grand Hotel movie, who's always running around going, I've only got 5 minutes to live. So it's marvelous dark humor. They're really enjoying themselves.
Now, Kringleine, that character, is he in your previous volume 1 and 2, did he show up in those, or is 3
he,
where he's...
He shows up, they first started the Grand Hotel among the last 3 or 4 episodes with... Ethel Chute and George Olsen.
Okay.
So it started at the 3/4 of the way through volume 2.
Okay.
And they got a lot of publicity about it. They claimed it was one of the first movie parodies, mm-hmm. and nothing is ever the first.
No.
And there were some people in vaudeville who were doing movie parodies, sure. but they got a lot of good publicity for it.
And it was Jack's first movie parody, so there you go.
Yes. So, whatever. So they bring back the character Kringleine. They do mm-hmm. Grand Hotel again. And so they think things are fine again. Now I can say off mic what's happened. The soft landing that Sid Silvers gets, hooray for him, is that, remember I mentioned that he was a part of a Broadway musical comedy that had died in tryouts in Pittsburgh. Well, the backers and the, they put the show back together again, still had Ethel Merman with it. I think still had
Jack.
He goes back with the show and it becomes the toast of Broadway.
Oh, nice.
So,
good for him.
There is no way that Sid could have actually been on the radio on these random nights.
Yeah.
As well as
it would have lost him anyway. Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, so hooray for Sid.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that they didn't really hate each other. I think that because they do appear together in Hollywood in, is it the Broadway Review of 1936 or one of them? One of the before Paramount films. They're together and you don't see them going. Sid Silvers, after his, he's like six months of good long run on this Broadway show, he goes back out to California, where most of the time he's a writer for comedians. So Sid goes on to have a fine little life, doesn't become a great huge name, but has a fine little life.
Good.
It turns out that Canada Dry, earlier than I had thought, put out the word that we're firing you. So it was soon after December the 10th when they get their show back, they know they've been let go. And you really start to see the melancholy seep into the show in January.
Okay.
After the happiness of having Gracie and George burst into their show, actually Jack plays his violin a bit. And they do a couple episodes where Mary takes the cake as they're doing parodies of old melodramas.
Okay.
Birth of the Sewing Machine Girl. One of these things about the rent is due and the young girl goes to the city and you know she's actually you know, becoming a prostitute or sleeping your way to the top, but they don't.
Right.
So as I said, it's a little bit melancholy. And in the very last episode, Jack does not thank the sponsor.
Oh.
You know, and he just says, okay, Mrs. Benny, it's time for us to leave.
Wow.
And they just walk away. So,
and that's, so that's the last episode for
Canada Dry.
Canada Dry. Then.
Then
how long is that next break? Like 3 weeks or something? Or
because they were triply screwed over. That the advertising agencies say you're a used comedian. You've done so well with Nickelback on the bottle and the Canada Dry ads that no right. other sponsor will take you. Right. They don't want to see that you're great at inventing this stuff. They think you're a used comedian with Canada Dry plastered all over your face.
Right.
It's smack in the middle of the season. Mm-hmm. And there weren't such things as a mid-season replacement.
Right.
At that point, the whole radio commercial schedule was so new.
Yeah.
And so everybody was tied up and possible for multiple years.
Right.
So there was literally
no place.
You
would think he'd have to wait till the following season at best.
Yeah, there was no place for Jack to go. What Jack actually did, Jack, Mary, and Harry Kahn went back to NBC again because they had a good friend named Bertha Brainerd, who was the vice president of program sales at NBC. She had put the first, in May 32, she'd put Olsen and Chute together with Benny mm-hmm. and created that show and sold it to Canada Dry. So they come back to her and go, can we come up? What can we do? Can we, you know, she's happy to try and get another show going. Unfortunately, Olsen and Chute would love to be involved, but they're tied up with something else.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? What are we going to do? They're searching around. It doesn't look like there's going to be anything. And then all of a sudden, Mr. Huge Ego, Al Jolson, walks away from his show.
What so there's Jolson a hole in the about, schedule now that, at this
what
point.
What Jolson was upset about was that, you know, he went out to Hollywood to make movies,
mm-hmm.
and then he's married Ruby Keeler, and she's becoming the, you know, the big Warner Brothers musical, you know, star.
Right.
But this show of his has him traveling from city to city every week doing remotes.
Oh, geez.
And he's going, I hate this. He says, why can't I be in California? Why?
Like everybody else.
So because he had a huge ego and he was the number one entertainer, highest paid entertainer in the U.S. at that point, he could walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just walks away the 1st of February, breaks his contract. And
I always love this kind of thing because, so he walks away because they're putting him in different towns every week.
Yeah.
Then Jack comes in, takes over. I bet they don't have Jack going from different towns every week. They probably have him in one place.
What is going to happen is that here's the difficulty. And this is the movie industry and radio had the performers were actually meshed together, but the sponsors hated the film industry.
Right.
You know, and the film industry hated the sponsors. And so what Jack wanted to do, he was under contract to MGM.
Right.
At this point, and then making movies at RKO. And what Jack wanted to do was to travel back and forth. Hollywood wanted him to be in California permanently.
Yeah.
Radio wants him to be in New York permanently. And so that is why we're going to see from 33 to 36 or 37, we're going to see him change band leaders so often.
Right.
It's because when he's in New York, he can use an NBC band leader. But when he travels to California, they can't leave. Because there are four other shows and play at a nightclub. So he has to get a different band leader in California, but they can't leave and go back with him to New York.
So he kind of has two different casts, one for New York, one for California.
So it ends up being a different one all the time.
Okay.
It's very random. And he has 10 different announcers during this time period. And that's what gives him the idea of putting like Don Wilson under contract.
Right.
What he's going to do in 34. Of I can't stand, I want more control over my show. How can I create these characters if I've got a different announcer all the time?
Right.
So.
Yeah.
He's very down in the dumps on the last Canada Dry show because he doesn't know what the future holds. He's hearing from NBC again that they don't have something for him. Vaudeville is dead. You know, that he's not really good at the musical comedy reviews, which are really blue at that point.
Yeah.
His films aren't really making enough money. You know, he's really at loose ends. And thank goodness for Al Jolson leaving. And Bertha Brainerd cobbles together a now, show, many, and they how actually many will.
Scripts in the book are from this time period of the where he took over the Jolson show.
The first script of volume four.
So. Oh, okay. So this just takes us up through him being done with
him being fired and then giving the heads up about what happened with Jolson and okay. to say then they're going to start this.
But the Jolson starts in volume four. Okay.
The first script of volume four, they were back on the air the night of Franklin Roosevelt's inauguration.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know, your history when he's only saying, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Yep.
He starts the bank holiday. It's the absolute most dreadful bottom of the depression and yet this hope. And here they are on the radio that night talking about the inauguration. So they're going to do more political humor for a while until Chevrolet says, quick.
Which I kind of like, so that's good.
Yeah. So
now does so as a preview to volume four, does he almost immediately kind of go back to the style of the show before the whole Sid Silvers thing, or does it take time to morph back?
They're really polishing the show the way that they had done during Ethel Schutte and a George Olsen period. They get a male singer now. I think Mary could have had something to do with this too. That she's, you know, this is when she becomes the only woman on the show.
Yeah.
And so they get a couple really good announcers, mm-hmm. like Howard Klaney and Aloy Havrilla. They get a couple good announcers. I believe this is about the point where they hire Frank Parker as singer, but he takes on.
In the next volume, Frank Parker at some point will probably show up.
Yes, I think it's pretty soon.
Okay.
And so. I think Frank Black.
Come not too far down the road. Is Don like Frank volume Black five or something? Or
yes, Don gets hired in October 34 when Chevy has fired them and they start with General Tyre. That's when Jack says, "I've got to get more control of things," and Don is the first person he puts under personal contract. So,
very good. Wow.
So much is going on. The comedy develops. You start seeing that, I can tell that's Jackman. So.
Okay. And then your intro on this new book is longer because you have to talk about all this stuff. But I'm just trying to get in my brain, how much is it, like twice as long as your old intros, you think, or three times as long? Or
No, about twice as long. It's 10,000 words. It's the length of one of the chapters of my book.
Okay. So, excellent.
So, and all new stuff and great fun. Other things I'm grateful for are things that aren't in Jack Benny's papers, but through these digitized access to the trade journals, the business journals, and local newspapers, it was a golden age of a radio of important, influential radio reviewers in the early 30s. Those people would sort of go by the wayside by the late 30s because there becomes so little to report on.
Right.
What's going to happen is the performers in radio get locked in this early age,
mm-hmm.
and then they stay on for years and years and years and years and years. And there becomes less and less for radio writers to report on.
Right.
So,
other than the occasional new show or something, like when Phil gets a new show or something, and that's it. Yeah.
So it's going to be very few and far between. So.
Oh. And then in your intros, I'm trying to remember, Do you talk about what reviewers are saying at the time and things about some of the episodes and so forth?
Every good review I can find, and there were some really interesting ones. There was the radio editor in Buffalo wrote, I'm going to miss you, Jack Benny. You've been marvelous, and it's like Whereas I said, a few others enjoyed the snark of reporting on trying to create a feud between Benny and Sid Silvers, or Benny and NWA Air and the sponsor. So it ends up Canada Dry would just say to hell with it. And they would get back out of radio and they would only come back with Information Please, a favorite program of mine that started in 1938. So
interesting. So I'm just so excited about these. These three volumes are fantastic, and I love how they cover now we're out of the every other week. I mean, every twice a week, Benny shows.
At the end of volume three.
Yeah, so. and then volume four is going to be starting up the once a week shows that we're going to continue from then on. Yeah.
Right, and also the other things we'll see is a gradual reduction in the number of songs.
Yes.
You know, the expansion of comedy and the reduction of music is just going to, as well as they said it by volume. Well, Andrea Marsh has very little to do in volume three, so we're going to see Mary's part expanding tremendously as she gains more confidence, and because she was very popular, it's really interesting to see in the early days of the radio fan magazines that she is getting lots of newspaper articles and radio articles written about her. So, you know, we think of her as the, you know, the character on the side. We think of her as fading out in the late 40s, but she and Jack were really considered a team.
Okay. Yeah, for sure.
In this time period. So.
Now, for volume four, five, future volumes and things, like you say, they're going to have less musical performances, which means more scripts. So the scripts are going to get thicker. Are you still planning on doing probably around 25, 26 per volume? Or do you think you're going to drop it down to 20 or something because there's going to be more? Yeah. Do you have any ideas?
It's going to be, and you know, I'll be consulting with you off mic. I want to do the best job of making, not having people think they have to slog through things.
Yes.
It may be that if we have really good recordings available for some of the Buck Benny episodes, that I can just summarize those.
Yeah.
I want to keep the series affordable. I want to keep making progress.
And not have it endless. And I totally get that. There's going to be a sweet point.
I'm most excited to get going with the Jell-O era once they start going full of force into the parodies and sort of dial down the Buck Benny skits, which are kind of fun but kind of repetitive.
So the Chevy one that you're going to be into now, next time, is one season essentially, right?
It's parts of two seasons. Since they start in March, it'll be the next, you know, will be March through, I think, June. And then at the very depths of the Depression, when Chevy didn't know if it was going bankrupt,
right,
they said, we can't afford to advertise. And so they're off the air and they pick it back up again sometime in the fall.
Okay.
But then what is going to happen at the end of the Chevy era, Chevy gets a new CEO, a new company president, and he likes polka music.
Yeah, he likes music programs, I remember, right? Yeah.
He hates comedy. And so he just summarily fires Jack Benny and puts on sponsors a polka music show. And Jack would never talk about this. That firing from Chevy is the lowest point of his professional radio career, other than, you know, maybe the gem smuggling, you know, business.
I would assume, coming in from Jack's angle, he's like, okay, I lost Canada Dry.
Yeah.
And now I've lost Chevy. And people were already talking about how it was damaged goods. Now I'm doubly damaged goods. I probably have no chance now. It's probably done for me.
Exactly. And he's furious because he's high in the ratings.
Right.
But what do you mean? You don't like comedy. Because there are some things you can find about local Chevy dealers, car dealers, going, damn it. If somebody, you know, who was going to buy a car in 1933? If you could get anybody into the showroom, you could get them. Chevy dealers, so you could get them talking about Jack Benny. You know, this was a sales tool. Please, God, what have you done? So when he gets,
but then you get him in the showroom and start talking about polka music, it just doesn't work as well.
So again, he's going to get fired at mid-season, and Bertha Brainerd is again going to move heaven and earth to get him a new sponsor. It's the depth of the Depression, and General Tire is going to be willing to pick him up. But they say, we don't have enough money to sponsor you for a whole season. So all he knows is that he's gotten another half season, and they're going to split it with a dying product called Jell-O. So it's really, the spring and summer of 34 are just going to be, he's so impacted.
And then General Tire, do they stick with him for half a year? Do they stick with him for
half a year? And they couldn't afford him anymore. And so they made publicity out of this, and they did the handshake of, we're going to send you to Jell-O, and then we'll have you back in 6 months, you know, and yet when Jell-O takes off, they go, oh no, But
we're just sticking with Jell-O. Oh, that's, and then he's with Jell-O for like 7 years or something. So that's
it's something like 11. Yeah. Yeah. So,
so that's great. Good for
you. So, hooray. It's going to be good times ahead for Jack. But so we're going to see him. We're in this episode. And and then what's going to happen? You know, then he's going to have the big fight with Harry Kahn. So once he gets, so the struggles will continue.
Well, and I have,
and professionally. So
I've loved the first two volumes far more than I thought I would. I mean, they're just so much fun to read, and they're so great. And then it's just going to get better. That's the thing. I mean, this one's more exciting than they are because there's so much going on. And then each volume will at this point, Jack is progressing in his career where he's the writing, the everything's getting better. And so I just keep looking forward to these. They're going to be great.
Hooray, hooray. Yeah. But I thank you for appreciating the first two because there are hidden gems in there. It's especially if you try and if you read it in Jack's voice, it's great.
Fun. It's great. It is. And I can't read it any other way. Jack just pops into my head and I can't, it's like he takes over. So it's okay. It's great. I love that. So much to look forward to. So folks, make sure if you haven't looked at these, you take a look. I mean, you know, I probably wouldn't buy all three volumes together in a set without at least looking at one. Cause I just don't want people disappointed or anything. If you're thinking it's something it's not, cause if you want a straight on Jack Benny book, then the one behind Kathy's head here is perfect that she's written. It is a great book that doesn't have things that are in all the other books about Jack Benny. And it's truly a book about Jack and his show and the folks involved in it and everything. But if you're an excited fan like I am to read the old scripts that you can't get anyplace else, this is fabulous. And then I would buy the three volumes if that's who you are. I just don't, you know, we want you to be someone who's going to be happy and I think you'd find if you get one of the volumes, you'll get some of the other ones. You know, I guess I would say, I'm just going to guess at this, Kathy, and you can jump on me if you don't think so, but if I was just going to go, I don't have any of the volumes, I want to try one, see if I like it, and I'll get the other ones, I'd probably maybe start with number three just because I think it's so interesting that I think, and then go back and pick up one and two, not to diminish one and two. It's just, there's so much going on in three.
Building. It's building. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's neat, you know, because you're going to get Mary throughout in this one. You're going to get, there's a lot of things you're going to get. You're going to get introduced to Schlepperman in this, or a version of Schlepperman anyway. I think
you're going to get, some good comic commercials.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's great. So anyway, we'll let it go there. And I can't wait. We've done one of these intros, I think, for volume one and then two, or one and two together. I can't remember. And now we've done three. We'll be back when volume four comes out. I can guarantee you. And I assume that's probably going to be before next Christmas. I would hope that we,
I sure hope so.
Wouldn't that be great?
Ben Omar willing.
I want this as a yearly Christmas present, and then I'm a happy, happy camper. So anyway, and I'm glad this one came out before Christmas. This is awesome. So get out there, get it, enjoy it. We'll have the links below. Use those links, get those books, and we'll see you folks next time. It's so much fun spending some time with Kathy doing these interviews. Oh. But it's also fun reading what Kathy's written for us. It's just
you're so kind, Daryl. I so appreciate your enthusiasm and love for Jack Benny and making such delightful conversations. Thank you so much.
And I love chatting with you about it. It is so awesome to just and that we can do this. I mean, this is great that we do these interviews every once in a while, but the fact that we can do it every week, and so often I'm in exposing you to a new episode, like this week there was a new episode you'd never seen.
Wonderful.
And, yeah.
Wonderful.
It's wonderful. Anyway, thanks everybody, and we'll see you all sometime in the future. Oh, and remember, tune into our shows because we come on every Sunday at 7 o'clock Eastern, 4 o'clock West Coast, and we have a new show on YouTube every week. So enjoy those shows as we keep bringing them to you, and we'll see you guys next time.